You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Glad to be together and open God's word together. This summer, we have been preaching through Genesis chapter 1 through 11 in the Old Testament. And the story has actually come full circle. It started in a garden, Eden, and it is ending here in a city, the city of Babel. But the stories end the same, don't they? The residents of both places end up getting evicted. Adam and Eve rebelled against God in the garden, and they got kicked out of the garden in Genesis 3. And here, the people of Babel rebel against God, and they get kicked out of the city. It's not too encouraging that the same thing would keep happening and that the story would end this way. Ever since Adam and Eve, rebellion actually seems to be a part of humanity's hardwiring. From Eden to Babel, the story has this recurring pattern. We've seen it this summer. It goes like this: sin, then judgment, then restart. Then sin, then judgment, then restart, again and again and again. And so one of the major themes in Genesis 1 through 11 that we've seen is that humanity, left to ourselves, will not improve. Like, we don't get better on our own. Apart from the work of God's redeeming grace in our lives, we don't just get better. We don't keep his commands. We don't draw near to him. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, God called Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. In other words, go out and create culture all over the earth. Fill the earth. Make a name for God all over the earth to his glory. It's like the Garden of Eden was this bright, colorful, fully finished painting, and the rest of the world was just a pencil sketch. And God said to Adam and Eve, hey, multiply people all over the world to color in the rest of the world. Like, fill the world with vibrant culture, all to the glory of God and for the sake of his great name. After the flood, in Genesis chapter 9, the command to Noah and his family was the same. God said to Noah, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, the whole earth. But then in Genesis chapter 10, we read about the great grandson of Noah. It's a guy named Nimrod, which nobody names their kids anymore, unfortunately. We've never had a Nimrod at a baby blessing down here. I'm not sure why. It's a solid biblical name, so one of you might choose it at some point. Here's what we read about Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10. Nimrod was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. He founded Babel. You know what Nimrod means? It means we will rebel. This is why nobody names their kid Nimrod. Nimrod rebels against God's command to fill the whole earth. Nimrod's like, no, you know what? We're not going to do that. We're going to settle right here in one place. And he founds the city of Babel, which is the beginning of the ancient city of Babylon. Same word, Babel and Babylon. And in the Bible, Babylon is always the prototypical city of man. It's rebellious. It's prideful. It exalts itself against God. It seeks autonomy and self-sufficiency apart from God. Now, when God told Adam and Eve to fill the earth and have dominion, did he want people to build cities? I think so. I think all over the earth. Like, cities are cultural centers. They reflect the glory of God. They reflect the image of God. They are concentrated places of the image of God. But God doesn't want people to build cities in self-centered pride. He doesn't want cities to become monuments of human autonomy and self-sufficiency. And this city in Genesis 11 is exactly that, isn't it? It's the very picture of pride and autonomy and self-sufficiency. The people of Babel don't want God. They want the things of God, just independent of God. They want the things of God, just without God. And so here is a simple structure of this narrative. We need to look at this narrative because it's a cautionary tale for us, because that inclination is in us too, to want the things of God without God. Here's a simple structure of this narrative. Humanity builds up, then God comes down. Humanity builds up, then God comes down. This story is a chiasm, meaning it goes in one direction, and then all of a sudden it reverses in mirror image. So there's 9 verses in this story. In the first 4 verses, humanity builds up, and then verse 5 is the exact middle point of the story, and that's when God comes down. And then verses 6-9 are a mirror image reversal of verses 1-4. It's a divine reversal of what humanity does in the first 4 verses. Let's look at it. Let's look at this first section, that humanity builds up. In rebellious pride, humanity builds upward. Look at verse 1. Genesis 11, verse 1. If you want to turn there, there's some Bibles in front of you. It's on page 7 in those Bibles. Genesis 11, verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language, literally one lip. Everybody spoke the same language. They had the same words. Now he mentions the whole earth, and you're going to see that phrase, the whole earth, or all the earth, several times today. So geographically, this story starts with the whole earth in mind. Then it's going to narrow down to one place, Babel, and then it's going to end by going back out into the whole earth, because God cares about the whole earth, right? Verse 2. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. Now, some translations say as people migrated toward the east, or as they migrated eastward, which I think is actually a better translation, because in the Bible, anytime somebody's heading eastward, it means they're heading away from the presence of God, which is what the people are doing here. They are outside of his will. They're defying God. They're saying to God, no, we're going to settle here in one place. And what's interesting is that where they settle in the land of Shinar is pretty much the exact location of where the Garden of Eden was believed to have been. So Genesis 1-11 actually does come full circle, even geographically. God said, go fill the earth. And they were like, no, we're going to settle here, right where we started. We're going to stay here. Verse 3, and they said to one another, they're able to talk to one another because they all have the same language. Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, they had bitumen, or tar, for mortar. And then they said, hey, come, let us build ourselves a city. Let us build ourselves a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. This is not a haphazard building project. This is very organized. It's very deliberate. They are using new technology here. They're firing bricks in the kiln. They're using tar for mortar. They're not building a temporary structure. They're trying to build something great and glorious, something that will last. They're using their ingenuity to build this carefully coordinated urban center where lots of people can live for a long time. Some commentators think this is the beginning of humanism as a philosophy. You know, humanism as opposed to theism puts man and his interest and his abilities at the center of life instead of putting God at the center of life. So humanism is the glory of humanity, the abilities of humanity for the sake of humanity. Now, what were these people looking for as they built this city? I said it before, I think they're looking for the things of God, just independent of God. For example, they're looking for unity, aren't they? Just on their own terms. Like, they know they can't make it in this crazy world by themselves. They need other people. They can't go it alone, so they unite with others, but they unite on their own terms. It's a unity based on uniformity. Everybody's the same. They speak the same language. It's a unity based on their abilities, their interests, their ambitions. It's a unity actually centered around directly disobeying the very command that God gave them. So it's a unified rebellion. It's unity independent of God. It's false unity. They're also looking for security, just on their own terms. Did you catch their reasoning in verse 4? Look at it. In verse 4, they say, let's build ourselves a city. Why? Lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. In other words, the mission of God does not seem safe, right? God is calling us out there, but it's much safer in here. So let's settle down here and fortify. Let's build walls to protect ourselves. But in walling themselves off from the world, they're actually walling themselves off from the will of God. It's security independent of God. It's false security. They're also looking for significance, just on their own terms. And this is where you see the humanistic enterprise in full bloom. Verse 3 and 4, they say, let us make bricks. Let us build ourselves a city and a tower. Let us make a name for ourselves. It's all about what they can do. It's all about creating their own meaning. It's all about making a name for themselves. But in God's economy, we don't make a name for ourselves. We don't. God gives us a name. God said to Abraham, I will make your name great. He said the same thing to David. I will make your name great. God is the one who gives us a name. God is the one who actually gives us meaning and significance in our lives. And so the people of Babel are looking for significance independent of God. It's false significance. And finally, I think they're looking to worship, but just on their own terms. On their own terms. They say, let's build a tower with its top in the heavens. One of the dominant architectural structures in early Mesopotamian cities were these towers called ziggurats. A ziggurat was a multi-tiered tower with a large stairway ascending to heaven. You know I listened to Stairway to Heaven this week. I had to. It's a great song. That's what's happening here. They're building a stairway to heaven. Like at the top of the tower was a temple or a shrine to a particular deity, as if God was just a localized deity and not the universal God. And in that shrine or that temple, sometimes there was a room with a table set and a bed so that the deity could come down and refresh himself. And they could talk with him and they could convince him and he could bless the people. As if God is just like us and has needs that we can meet and he can be sweet-talked and manipulated and bribed in some way. See, the problem with the ziggurat was not the people's desire to be in touch with God. That's a good desire. The problem was their belief that they could reach God on their own efforts. The problem is that they were creating a God in their own image. They were trying to bring God down to their level. The problem is they were trying to manipulate God, right? This city was called Babylon, Babylim in the Akkadian language, which is what they spoke, which means gate of the gods. Gate of the gods. So they named their city the very thing that was that their worship was based on. This is where God comes down, where the gate of the gods, but it was worship independent of God. It was false worship. Now, before we get too judgmental on the Babylonians, I think we ought to consider how we do the same thing, because we do. Like, how do we pursue unity, security, significance, and worship on our own terms, even as Christians? I think living in a city makes that easier. I think living in a city like ours, life in a city where we have almost anything we want at our fingertips, makes it possible to live as if God doesn't exist, even though we believe that he exists. So how do we pursue false unity? Well, I think in a city like ours, there are enough people who look like us, think like us, have the same ambitions as us, that we could just form alliances based on sameness, uniformity. Like we can choose those with whom we want to be unified such that we don't even have to trust God. So things like clubs and friend groups and fraternities and political alliances, like these are good things, but they can begin to form a unity based on pride, based on the exclusion of others, right? This can even happen in the church, but it's a unity without God. Like it's picking and choosing whom we'll be unified with. How do we pursue false security? Well, I just need to ask myself, what is it that I think will keep me safe in the world? Like, is it my bank account balance? Is it my 401k balance? Is it my job? Is it my resume? Is it my health? Is it my home security system? Is it my gun? Is it because I live in a country with the most powerful military the world has ever known? What keeps me safe and secure in the world? What am I trusting? How do I pursue false significance? I think it's easy in a city like ours to cross the line from living for the glory of God to living for the glory of self, trying to make a name for ourselves. Because there's pressure in a city like ours, isn't there? Like pressure to make a mark, pressure to be significant, pressure to stand out. So I think it's good to ask ourselves, do I find myself wanting to be known for something? I want to be good at something, but I want to be known for that. I want to be known as the really smart guy. I want to be known as the person who's well-connected or super successful, or I want to be known as the person who has a nice house with everything updated and perfect. Or we want to be known as the couple who has high-achieving kids, right? Or I want to be known as the person who's theologically savvy. How do you crave praise for your own name rather than finding significance in who God says you are? And then finally, how do I pursue false worship? Again, I think this is so easy to do in a city, to approach worship on our own terms, because there's so many options. We can just be consumers. There's so many choices. So we need to ask ourselves, do I have my own little ziggurat? Ways that I'm trying to reach God on my own efforts, or ways that I'm trying to bring God down to my level and manipulate him or control my interaction with him. Like I can only worship God in this way or in this place or in this style. As if God is exactly like us and our worship of him depends on our preferences. We need to deal with God as he really is, not just according to our preferences. Otherwise, it's just false worship. The Babylonians don't want God. They want the things of God, independent of God. Now, what's God's response to this? Well, his response is he comes down. Look at verse 5, the second half of the story. Verse 5 is the pivot point, the turning point in this story. Verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. Don't miss the satire and what's being said here. This is divine derision. What does God have to do if he wants to see this great city and this tall tower that they've built? He's got to come down, right? The tower might reach into the heavens, but God has to stoop to see it. It'd be like me getting down on my hands and knees in my front yard to inspect an ant pile. And I'm saying to the ants, hey, good job, guys. I mean, this looks like a tiny pile of dirt to me, but good work on that. This is what's happening here. Notice that it says the city and the tower were built by the children of man. That phrase is very intentional because it translates as the sons of Adam. This is human achievement. It's humanism. It's probably the greatest achievement up to this point. It's what the sons of Adam can pull off. It's what they can do. But God has to descend even to see it. I mean, we have towers like this in Austin. They're going up all, there's cranes everywhere downtown, going up all, reaching to the heavens. The tallest one is gonna be at 6th and Guadalupe. It's opening this fall. There's gonna be another one down on Rainey Street that opens in 2026 that'll be the tallest building in the state of Texas. We got soaring to the heavens, but God says, hey, I can't even see those things without coming down. Your greatest achievements, I have to stoop to see. But God doesn't just come down to see what's going on. He comes down actually here to do something about it. He comes down in judgment. And I want you to watch how his judgment in this passage mirrors the human activity that preceded it. It's a divine reversal of the Babylonian rebellion. Look at verse 6. Verse 6, and the Lord said. So in verses 3 and 4, the people were speaking. Now in verses 6 and 7, God's going to speak. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. God doesn't doubt human ability. He created human beings. He knows what they're capable of. They're smart. And they all speak the same language. So they're going to be able to plot and plan and pull off all kinds of stuff. Verse 7, come, God says, let us go down. That word us means there's a plurality in the Godhead. We've seen it in Genesis already. It's the Trinity having a conversation, intra-Trinitarian dialogue. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. And so in judgment, God confuses their language, disrupting their false unity. God was not about to stand by and allow a unity that would defy him and destroy the human race. So he confused their language. And from that point on, it would be difficult for humanity to unite in global plans to deny him and to disobey him. He restrains evil alliances. Why? For the good of humanity. He destroys their delusion of self-sufficiency. Why? To protect them from further hardness of heart. Look at verse 8. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth. So in judgment, God scatters them over the face of the whole earth, right? Disrupting their false security, which seems really harsh. It's like he's sending them out into the Wild West, unprotected, vulnerable. But the reality is, and we got to believe this, there is no security outside of the Lord. No matter where you are, the only security, real security, is only in him, with him, in walking in his ways, doing his will. Continuing in verse 8, and they left off building the city. How tragic is that? They stopped. It was an incomplete construction project. They stopped building the city. Verse 9, therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. So in judgment, God disrupts their false sense of significance. The people had been seeking to build a city for themselves, but instead the city is left unfinished. It's like a ghost town. The people had been seeking to make a name for themselves, but instead they got the notorious name Babel. Remember, they had called the city Babylon, which is the Akkadian name for it, but that sounded a lot like the Hebrew word for confusion. So in mockery, God gave them the name Babel. He's like, you want a name? I'll give you a name. Your name is Confused. That's who you are. You're confused. They were trying to be famous, but God made them infamous. And finally, in judgment, God disrupts their false worship. See, the tower, the ziggurat that they were building falls way short. They intended for their city to be the gate of God, the place where God met with human beings, but God was not interested in human beings defining the terms of worship. And God was not interested in confining worship to one place. His purpose was to spread his name over the whole earth, to fill the whole earth with his glory, to fill the earth with God worshipers, to multiply God worshipers everywhere. And so he kicks the Babylonians out of the city. He disperses them. And I think if the story ended here with God's judgment on their sin and on the rebellion, this would truly be a tragic story. But we know this is not the end of the story. As we read on, we begin to see that God's judgment in this account was not meant to condemn humanity. It was actually meant to save humanity from itself. His judgment is actually gracious. It's what's good for them. When my girls were little, I coached a few of their soccer teams, and my soccer knowledge goes up to about age 6, but that's when I would retire, usually, after they were 6. And the one thing that I said all the time when I was coaching 6-year-old girls playing soccer, you know the one thing that I would say all the time from the sideline? Spread out! Have you ever seen a little kid soccer game? It's like a blob going around the ball, wherever it goes. I'd be like, spread out! I would run this drill at practice where I would have them line up on the end of the field, 10 yards apart from one another. And I would say, just run to the other end of the field and don't get any closer to someone else than you are right now. Just run to the other end in a straight line, and they could not do it. They'd start off and then they'd just come together. Can't do it. I was not trying to spread them out in the soccer games because I wanted to disunify them. Because I didn't want them to be around one another. I wasn't spreading them out so that they would lose. I was spreading them out because it was the best thing for them as soccer players to use the whole field, to work together. It's how soccer works, allegedly. God in his grace says to the people at Babel, spread out, fill the earth. I've been saying it all along. It's the only way to fulfill your destiny as human beings. It's the only way to walk in my purposes for you and to be fully human. Spread out, fill the earth. So his judgment in spreading them out is an act of grace. God's grace is the theme of the larger story. In fact, God's grace propels the story forward as we get into chapter 12 after this. When we come to Genesis 12, which is the very next chapter, God says to Abraham, it's the first thing he says to him. He says, leave your country. In other words, spread out to a land that I'm going to show you. And Abraham, I'm going to make your name great. And all the families of the earth are going to be blessed through you, Abraham. So unlike the people of Babel, Abraham obeys God. He doesn't settle in one place. He leaves his home by faith. He trusts God's promise that God will bless all the families of the earth through him. And that's what happens. Centuries later, one of Abraham's descendants, Jesus of Nazareth, would be the fulfillment of that promise to Abraham. And in Jesus of Nazareth, the Lord came down, didn't he? Like we said, verse 5 is the turning point, the pivot point of the Babel story. The Lord came down. It's actually the turning point of all of human history. That God doesn't just come down in judgment. He comes down in Jesus. He comes down in grace. Like, it's the gospel story. God the Son in the person of Jesus Christ came down to die on a cross, thus defeating sin, and to be raised from the dead, thus defeating death. The gospel story is actually the exact opposite of the Babel story. At Babel, man in his hubris builds upward, trying to reach God on his own, trying to hold on to his life and achieve immortality for himself. But in the gospel, God in his humility comes down to earth, and he doesn't hold on to his life, he gives his life away. Not so he can achieve immortality, but to purchase immortality for others. That's the gospel. Through his death and resurrection, Jesus brings us true unity. People that never would have gotten together, Jews and Gentiles, are now one people called the church, and he allows that unity. Jesus brings us true security, like eternal security, like he'll never let us go kind of security in his kingdom, and he purchased our security through his vulnerability. Jesus brings us true significance. How? Well, he has the name that is above all names, and he says, hey, I'll share that name with you. You're my brothers and sisters. You can share my name. And so if you're a Christian, you don't have to make a name for yourself. You got one. You got a great one. And then Jesus brings us true worship. In other words, he is the true gate of God. He is the intermediary between us and God. We can approach the throne of grace with confidence, not because of what we've done, not because of what we bring to the table, but because of what Jesus has done. Jesus gives us the things we long for: unity, security, significance, worship, but he gives us God also. At the end of history, Jesus is going to reverse the sin and judgment of Babel. Jesus is going to bring people from every nation, from every language, back together under his kingship. Listen to this. Revelation chapter 5, last book of the Bible, says this. And they sang a new song, saying, you, Jesus, are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you, Jesus, were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and every language and every people and every nation. All those that were dispersed at Babel, you've purchased people from those groups. And you have made them to be a kingdom and priest to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth, the whole earth. So in Jesus, God establishes his kingdom on earth through humanity, which was his plan all along. It's glorious. And the biblical story actually is destined for life in a city. Just not a city like Babel, not the city of man. I'll close with this from Revelation 21, next to the last chapter of the Bible. Then I saw a new heaven. I saw a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be their God." The city of God comes down to earth. It's the city we long for. It's the city we dream of. It's the city we want. It's the city of God, and it's ours in Christ. Thanks be to God. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.